طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. We begin this morning with the introduction of a podcast which has a similar mission to that of This Week in Palestine. It is a podcast created by Nadia Aboulazam called Palestinians Podcast, and its mission is to give voice to the Palestinians telling their stories. It can be accessed on the internet through PalestiniansPodcast.com. We sat down with Nadia to let her tell her story about the creation of Palestinians Podcast and a bit about her journey growing up Arab in America. Nadia Aboulazam is a second-generation Palestinian who was raised in the San Francisco area. Nadia is an assistant professor at the Boston College School of Nursing and is an epidemiologist. Her research interests are in the intersection of infectious disease epidemiology, mathematical modeling, and HIV/AIDS. Her current research focuses on the use of mathematical models to better understand the impact of treatment and prevention strategies on HIV incidence and prevalence in sub-Saharan Africa. The goals of her program of research are to use quantitative methods and novel data streams to better understand the inequalities in healthcare distribution and access in resource-poor settings. Here is our interview with Nadia. Nadia, in Palestinians Podcast, you want Palestinians to tell their stories. We want to introduce the podcast to the listeners of This Week in Palestine by having you tell your story, because our goals are very similar. Both programs want to feature the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian story. So, tell us a bit about yourself, your family, and what it was like growing up as a Palestinian Arab in America.
Sure, thank you for having me. My name is Nadia Aboulazam. As was mentioned, I created and I host Palestinians Podcast. I actually was born and raised in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area. My parents were both refugees from Palestine. My dad grew up in a refugee camp in southern Lebanon, and my mom was fortunate enough to live in Kuwait after being born in Palestine. And both immigrated to the United States and settled in San Francisco. And they met there and they got married in San Francisco. So I actually, up until about the seventh grade, I lived in San Francisco, surrounded by a very large Palestinian community, I would say. We had a very large community, partially because of our religious affiliation. We had a large Greek Orthodox community, but also because my entire extended family lived in within a five-mile radius of our house. So I grew up surrounded by my cousins. They were my first friends, and still are my friends till today. But really, not truly understanding what it meant to be Palestinian when I was younger. I understood that we spoke Arabic. I understood that our skins might have been a little darker than others, but I didn't really understand Palestine. And it wasn't actually until I can remember a specific instance in the sixth grade. We were asked to do country reports, a report about a particular country. And I told my teacher that I wanted to do a report on Palestine. And the teacher took me to the Atlas and said, I can't find Palestine in the Atlas. And he said, there's no map for Palestine, and there's no flag for Palestine, so you can't do Palestine for your country. So I ended up choosing Egypt. And it was at that moment that I sort of realized that where I came from was a little bit different than where everyone else came from. It was instances like that that made me, that sort of perked up my ears to this idea of Palestine. My parents weren't activists. They still aren't. They're just people who want to live their lives peacefully here in the United States. But this activism sort of brewed up inside of me as I grew up and experienced these microaggressions that really, I mean, I'm not sure people really intended them to be microaggressions, but they really were. And I sort of now can look back and contextualize them. But as a young child, I had no way of knowing what was really happening. My family moved to Arizona because my dad is a serial restaurant owner. He just owns one restaurant after the other. That's sort of his business model. And he found a good opportunity in Scottsdale, Arizona, which is a very wealthy and white town in Arizona. We lived there for about 4 years. And in the middle of that four-year period, September 11th happened. And it really did change my life, and it changed my perspective on my peers, because that day was really a very difficult day for me. I was in high school at that time, and some teachers allowed students to have an open discussion about the day's events. And I was really attacked outright for being an Arab. Called horrible names. Teachers couldn't really do anything about it because it was an open discussion. And I felt like I had to defend myself as an Arab in those situations. And eventually the administration actually handpicked all of the Middle Eastern students and sent them home before the end of the day. A Pakistani kid had gotten attacked in the hallway, and so they decided that anyone who was remotely brown or Arab was going to be sent home. So my perspective on Arizona really changed at that point. My dad lost his business largely due to the discrimination he faced after September 11th. Most of his customers didn't come back. He's a very clearly Arab, accent-wielding man. So it really did change our life in a very substantial way. We were forced to move back to California, back to close to our extended family in California, sort of that comfort area, being close to other Arabs. And at that point, I sort of didn't want to be associated with being Arab or Palestinian. Really was just something I was, and not something I really wanted to bring to the forefront in any way. And I really did manage to excel in school. That's partially because I have, you know, immigrant parents who really value education. And I didn't really get the fire for Palestine again until I was in my graduate program here in Boston. I just saw that there was a lack of attention given to, from my perspective, because I am someone in the public health field, a lack of attention given to a lot of the health issues that are going on in Palestine. And that's really where sort of this reactivation of my Palestinian-ness, if you will, happens. Just this idea of a lot of attention being placed on Israel and no attention being placed on Palestine. At the time, when I was in graduate school, I would walk to and from my apartment to work, and I often would listen to podcasts on my way. It was a way to pass the time, and I really did find myself feeling very emotional about certain stories I was listening to on shows like This American Life or Snap Judgment or things like that. And I just realized this was a way for us as Palestinians, as an unheard people, to really tell our own story. I found that audio, different from video, was a way to engage the listener personally in the narrative. And I decided one day that I was going to create this podcast. So it was really a spur-of-the-moment decision. And I began collecting audio from Palestinians I knew in the Boston area. And since then, it's grown to be something a little bit more international, where we've featured Palestinians from Palestine and from Europe, and we're hoping to feature some Palestinians from South America too. But as a child, I never really was Palestinian. I was always Arab. It wasn't about Palestine. But I feel like I have a responsibility now. I have a responsibility to the displacement of my parents, to bring out the Palestinian narrative in those who I talk to and those who I interact with. I still have a lot of trouble with that. I still have a lot of trouble when someone says, "Where are you from?" I still have a lot of trouble saying, "From Palestine." It's still very difficult, because I've experienced so much backlash in the past from saying that. Yeah.
So growing up, you did not tie into it at all, the sort of pro-Palestinian rights, and your family didn't, and so this was not until you came to Boston, and you sort of had this fierce. And your story is very similar to a lot of others I've heard, because first generation come to assimilate, and that's the goal. And their kids very often are the ones that then, you know, look at the politics and begin to say, "Whoa, what's going on here?"
Right. I mean, we as a family, we used to go to something called Palestine Day, which I remember. It's put on every year in September, and it's essentially a day to celebrate Palestinian culture and heritage. But again, I never really saw that as my event, as something that belonged to me. I saw it as something that my family would go to and we'd enjoy, you know, but it wasn't something that belonged to me. The cause never really felt like it belonged to me.
Yeah.
I knew my parents were from there, but I never really understood the need for my involvement until much later. And now I see it as an imperative. I mean, I don't think that I could, you know, in any good
conscience. There's no going back.
There's no going back. Yeah. No, absolutely not. And I don't think my parents were trying to shield me from anything. I think they were just, as you said, trying to live their lives in peace. And if it came up, it came up. Yeah.
And in terms of the founding of the podcast, you've surrounded yourself with quite a team of volunteers. It's grown from this. Talk about the growth.
Sure.
Of the podcast.
Sure. So we started releasing episodes officially in January of 2015. Prior to that, we had done a live storytelling show that was part of the Boston Palestine Film Festival in October of 2014. So as I mentioned, the podcast was really an idea I had in 2015. It was just something that I thought would be a good thing to do, but I didn't really know where to get the stories. I wasn't well connected with the Palestinian community in Boston. I sort of was a little isolated, so I wasn't sure how I was going to get these stories that I wanted to make a podcast out of.
So you had no colleague in this or friends that's...
Nope.
You talked this over with, this was just you.
It was me. It was really just me saying, I think this is a really good medium that we should explore. And I approached the Boston Palestine Film Festival with this idea of a live storytelling show where the audio from the show would be used in the podcast. That was the idea. And we did. We managed to have a sellout performance show in October of 2015. And I did. I used the audio from those stories and also additional interview material from those storytellers in the first few episodes of Palestinians Podcast. It really was me going out interviewing people, transcribing those interviews, creating a script, and then I actually had a volunteer. It's actually my, you know, a distant relative of mine in San Francisco who was doing the audio editing for me. It was a very volunteer, very sort of grassroots situation. We've managed to release one episode a month since we started, so we're now at 17 episodes, which is really exciting. I now have multiple volunteers who are helping me with sound editing. This summer, I have 4 interns who are helping me with podcast production. Mm-hmm. So it is growing. It's purposefully a slow growth. I'm not sure, because this is not my full-time job and we have no funding, I'm not sure that I would have been able to do it if it grew very quickly. So I'm glad that it's growing slowly, and we're really just getting the word out through word of mouth and things like that. The exciting piece of that, though, is that we've done more live storytelling events. We did another storytelling event in Boston. I just did in March a storytelling event at the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn. And we'll be doing a storytelling event in Chicago and Washington, D.C. this year.
Oh, nice.
So I really am enjoying these live events. It gives a sense of community, a community building, and also a chance for people who normally wouldn't be able to tell their story to tell their story to a large audience.
How do you make your contacts in those cities? Are these people that have heard the podcast and reached out to you, or...
Yeah, in some cases that's the situation. Mm-hmm. In other cases... it's just been the Washington, D.C. Palestine Festival for Arts and Film heard about the Boston event, and they wanted to do something similar to the Boston event. Mm-hmm. So it really varies. But I often do reach out to people and see if they're interested, because I think it's important to get more of a geographic spread to our stories. We're very Boston-based because mm-hmm. I live here, but we're really trying to get more people involved.
But as you grow sort of nationally, that becomes more and more difficult for someone who has a job in Boston. And
right. Yeah, I mean, and eventually I think it would be great to fund the podcast, to get it funded in some way. But we're not there yet. Yeah. We're still trying to figure that part out. It would be great to be able to pay people for the work that they do on the podcast, because it's a labor of love right now. And the wonderful part is getting emails in your inbox from people who've listened and have felt connected or touched. You know, I had an email from a woman who lives in Florida who, you know, she doesn't live near any Arabs or any Palestinians. And she feels like when she listens to the podcast, she feels a sense of community through it. And that really touches me. That means that I'm doing something that's helping someone in some way. Other than getting the word out about the narrative, I think it's building a community, which is exciting.
Which is important. Because I think to build a narrative, to get the narrative out, means finding different ways to do that, different forms, formats, and that involves people, and that involves community, and involves trying to turn on the community that needs to be speaking out.
Right.
And because your stories, like so many stories, people have these stories, but they don't tell them.
Yeah.
Fearful to tell them.
And that's the other thing, is that there is a fear. There's a fear of sharing your story, having your name out there in the world. And I think having this podcast and having these live storytelling events sort of tries to normalize the storytelling. You know, normalize this idea of it's okay to tell your story. There are other people who share your narrative. And while the details might be different across people, that sometimes the overall theme is the same. So I think hopefully it's starting to dispel some of that fear. But there still is fear in the community about sharing stories, especially in the older generations.
Well, and to be honest, the Palestinian community is one of the few communities where there is real pushback. You know, because the Zionist narrative is what you hear, and for those of us working on this issue and on Palestinian justice issues, we know about that pushback. We know what it's like to go to an event and a forum or speech and have pushback, real pushback, heavy pushback, and it's disconcerting, and it's very difficult.
I have received some of those emails.
I'm sure.
And not many. I have to say, compared to the positives, there's not many, knock on wood. But it does not disrupt the process or the need for what we're doing. So. Yeah.
Well, and in a sense, those are important moments. When you have a Joseph Massad or a Rashi Qadi, and they get hit in a forum, and they get with the Zionist narrative, and then to hear them come back, the pushback is speaking the truth. The pushback is what really happens. Pushback is history and the new historians, and they're speaking myth. You know, they're speaking the talking points. So those are important moments if you have someone that can counter that, because those are precious moments.
Right.
for students that don't know, haven't heard this before,
right.
to hear what comes and what the answer is,
right.
you know, so.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Since Trump's election, have you or your family or the podcast experienced any pushback, any difference?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think about this a lot. I can say that I personally have not experienced any difference. If anything, I feel like there is a little bit more support to talk about mm-hmm. some of these things. The communities, especially marginalized communities, have suffered, but they've also created safe spaces to have these discussions. And for that, I'm very grateful. We've actually, on the podcast, seen quite an uptick in listeners
since
the election. I'm not sure that there's a correlation there. It could just be coincidence. But we have definitely seen an uptick in listenership. As I said, my family doesn't really go out and do very activist things. And for that, I don't think, and especially the Bay Area is very much a melting pot.
Yeah.
Thank God we haven't experienced any adverse effects of Trump's Trump's presidency. Other than obvious, you know, emotional sort of reactions to things that have happened, specifically the Muslim ban and the potential consequences of such a ban on people we love and people we know. It's very almost traumatizing to think that something like that could be could happen.
Yeah, and I think things are changing. I think they're changing on the campuses, and I think it's not just within sort of the Palestinian community that's sort of saying, hey, we have a story to tell. It's within the Jewish community also with Jewish students that are looking at history and saying, whoa,
right.
you know, what's happening here?
Right.
And we see that in the work that we do in this community and on the campuses and the people we work with.
Right.
We see a real change, a real shifting. So that the work that we do to tell the story, you know, to play on those themes is just so important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And also drawing the connections to other marginalized communities
right.
is very important.
The intersectionality.
Absolutely.
And that is happening big time.
Yeah.
Black Lives Matter,
right.
The prison pipeline,
right.
Mass incarceration, all of that is... The dots are being connected.
Right.
And that's very encouraging. Okay, well, Nadia, thank you for speaking with us, and thank you for creating Palestinians Podcast. It's a gem, and we hope that we can help it grow. There are many opportunities to share stories and work together to promote the Palestinian narrative and the wealth of Palestinian stories. So thank you for sharing this, and I hope this is just the beginning.
Thank you.
And we'll find ways to connect in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
You have been listening to Nadia Aboulazam, creator and driving force behind Palestinians Podcast, which we highly recommend you check out. It can be reached at palestinianspodcast.com. Or just Google Palestinians Podcast. It is easy to find. For our second segment this morning, we feature journalist and author Max Blumenthal interviewing new Israeli historian Ilan Pappe on his newest book, 10 Myths About Israel, as recorded on the Real News Network.
Hi, I'm Max Blumenthal for The Real News. We're in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club for an event on the Israel lobby. And I'm here with Ilan Pappe, Israeli revisionist scholar, I guess we could call you that. And you're coming out with two new books. And I just got a galley of your latest, which is called the 10 Myths of Israel.
That's right.
So what is the biggest myth about Israel? Would it be, a land for a people, without a land. Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. I mean, what do you think the biggest myth is?
I think it's very difficult to choose, and that's why
you didn't have a top 10 list.
I chose chronology as the main regulator for the myth. So I began with the land without people and people without land. But I really think that the biggest myth of all has to do with how each of this myth does not allow us to understand the real nature of Zionism and the project of Zionism and the nature of Israel today.
Yeah, I think when you listen to Netanyahu, and he's sort of this master of expounding on this myth that Israel's not only not a settler colonial state, but that it's sort of a normal democracy that has flowered out of the Middle East almost organically because of the Jewish ancestral connection. And then when he talks about the conflict, or I wouldn't even call it a conflict, I'd call it a crisis. He always goes back to the Hebron riots. He goes back to these events that occurred before the State of Israel was founded, for example, attacks on Jewish communities in Jaffa, and never explains how those communities came there and what the real story was. So how do you challenge Netanyahu's narrative of Jewish-Arab relations in historic Palestine?
I think it's deeper than that. And Netanyahu, in this respect, represents a very deep Israeli-Jewish conviction that they are the indigenous people of Palestine, and the Palestinians are the settlers.
Yeah.
They are the aliens.
Yeah.
And this is the starting point. The starting point is we are the indigenous. Yes, we haven't been there for a few hundreds of maybe 2,000 years, but we are the indigenous people of Palestine. And from there, everything else emanates. And I think the way to challenge it is really by using this paradigm of settler colonialism, because it's not exceptional for a settler colonial movement to claim to be the indigenous people of the place that they occupy, colonize, and quite often genocide. It happened before in other places. And I think that's something that allows people who either were victims of other settler colonial projects or people who are part of settler colonial states like the United States,
right,
but are very familiar nowadays with their own history,
right,
and understand their own origins, to understand that actually it's not exceptional. It's not an exception. The only exceptional part of it is the denial, not the very historical act itself.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these myths are actually just Hasbara arguments by, in many cases, morons for the consumption of morons. But I found that in our world, there are a lot of, I mean, it falls on fertile soil. I mean, the education system isn't very good in the West. So you have these Netanyahu, and I think, you know, this is kind of a common feature of Hasbara, trying to draw a distinction between settler colonialism and traditional metropole colonialism. And you'll hear him say, you know, we're not the French colonizing Algeria. We have nowhere to go back to. You know, this is our homeland, and we can't go back anywhere. You know, how do you respond to that? And, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that we've failed to do is explain how settler colonialism is in many ways more pernicious than traditional colonialism.
Absolutely. The exceptional part of the story is that settler colonialism made certain connections or made certain assumptions which were accepted in the 19th century but looked ridiculous, inhuman, and non-democratic in the 20th century. And yet, in the particular case of Israel, they still remain valid. For instance, the claim that the only way you can create a democracy in a country which has settlers and natives is if the settlers are always the majority, which is the argument of the liberal Zionists, not the right-wing Zionists. The liberal Zionists, the whole peace process is based on the idea that the only way democracy can be sustained in Palestine is if the Jews are a majority in their own homeland.
Right.
So this is a ridiculous assumption that in any other context would be rejected as racist, but in the case of Israel is accepted.
Right.
And I think that's where the interesting part of the analysis comes into, I think, and also in my book, in the 10 minutes, why educated, well-read people in the West did not see this, or did they see it and decided to accept it for reasons of guilt, anti-Semitism because they didn't want the Jews to stay in Europe. God knows why. Everyone had their own reasons for that. For the second point that you were making, I think that it's very important to highlight when you talk about any settler colonial project, what Patrick Wolf called the logic of the elimination of the native. That you cannot create a new settler colonial society or a settler nation state from the settler colonial's perspective as long as there is an indigenous native population there. So you have to get rid of them.
Genocide
them as you did in America, or impose apartheid and Bantustan on them as you did in South Africa, or ethnically cleanse them as you did in Palestine. The means vary from one historical case study to the other. The logic is the same logic. And what is amazing is that this logic is still legitimized in the 21st century in the case of Israel under the guise of slogans such as the only democracy in the Middle East, a country that wants peace but doesn't find the right partner for it, and all the other mythologies that are connected to the peace process.
I think that the logic of the underlying logic of Zionism, of maintaining a demographic majority, a sort of ethnic overclass through violent demographic social engineering, is scarcely ever interrogated in our mainstream media. In academia, it's even very rare to see it. Would you say that that has fueled the rhetoric and the politics of the far right in Western Europe and in the United States, where you hear someone like Stephen Bannon, who's the chief counselor to Donald Trump, the main intellectual force behind him, say at a major conference in Washington that the United States is not just an economy, it has to represent a culture.
We have wide and sometimes divergent opinions, but I think the center core of what we believe, that we're a nation with an economy, not an economy just in some global marketplace with open borders, but we are a nation with a culture and a reason for being.
And it's this culturalist narrative which implies that the United States is white and Christian and it must maintain a white Christian demographic majority. Do you think that that has anything to do with the legitimization that Israel's experienced?
I do think so. I think if you are a member of a right-wing intellectual movement or ideological movement or political movement, you watch Israel desperately in a way. You say, my ideas, my assumptions, my discourse that is regarded as fringe, lunatic, and dangerous is welcomed when it is uttered by the spokespersons for the Israeli Jewish state or by Israel itself. It's exactly that. The dehumanization that Israel is allowed to express through its discourse, through its policies, through its activities is not different from any racist approach by any other group. In fact, settler colonialism is one of the most dangerous forms of modern racism. It's not surprising that the two ways in which Israel was trying to challenge this or protect this kind of exceptionalism, because it's very precarious. It can one day the truth can be discovered, and people would say, wait a minute, you're not different from an extreme right movement in America. You are the same, especially when the right wing in Israel becomes stronger. So there are two ways that trying to challenge it. One is by claiming that, we don't use violent means, if you're a liberal Zionist. We're not looking for violent means of keeping demographic purity. We're actually willing to give up some territory in order to keep demographic purity, or we enclave, we incarcerate, we besiege the Palestinians in small Bantustan so that we will be demographically pure.
In Israel, it's liberals saying build the wall.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Liberal, of course, because this means I don't want to use supposedly violent means. I'm not expelling people.
We're not going to transfer anyone.
Exactly. We're just not going to let them leave.
We're just going to say, it was Ehud Barak's campaign slogan.
Yeah, we are here and they are
us over
there.
Here, them over there. And we would recognize that here as sort of segregation.
Exactly.
But it's hard segregation.
Absolutely. And the second means by which they try to sort of hide it is the one that Netanyahu prefers, because he cannot say that he's willing to give up territory. And this is elevating this idea of elevating anti-Semitism into supposedly a new phenomenon,
right,
the new anti-Semitism, and to say that when you criticize Israeli settler colonialism, you're not criticizing racism, but you're actually racist yourself.
Yeah,
like the indigenous issue. If the Palestinians claim that they are indigenous, we will claim that we are the indigenous and they are the settlers.
Right.
It's this really new speak.
Which
world.
Actually embraces the true logic of anti-Semitism that conflates Zionism with Jews and holds them responsible collectively for all of Zionism's crimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's above another layer of uniformity or connection between the idea that Jews should be settler colonialists in Asia or the Arab world and not live as communities in the West, which is another kind of joint platform for anti-Semitism and Zionism.
Right, which opens the door for this kind of alliance of convenience we've seen with parties like the National Front in France. The Jobbik Party even in Hungary is moving away from its traditional anti-Semitism into a more pro-Zionist. We see the Austrian Freedom Party, Strascha, was hosted by the Likud Party.
Absolutely.
This is a party founded by Nazis in Austria. He was hosted for a visit of the Holocaust Museum by the Likud Party. You go across the board to all these far-right parties down to Trump and the Republican Party, and they've all become pro-Israel. Well, holding on to this idea that, you know, Jews really belong somewhere else.
And this is the whole notion of the Palestinians as immigrants. You have immigrants in Holland.
Yeah.
And you have all the right to vote for a right-wing party because they are really Muslim immigrants and they create all the problem. We also have Muslim immigrants in Israel and they're using the same methods to identify themselves, to operate politically and violently against our own culture, our own set of values.
Right. We it's understand kind of, the terrorism that
absolutely.
You're experiencing. We have it ourselves.
And there are very worrying connections nowadays between the Israeli strategic advisors and experts and their counterparts in France, Britain, Holland, Denmark. They advise them how to control immigrant societies in order to preempt the next loner, you know, the next
lone wolf.
And
it's what, through biometrics and racial profiling and what do they call it, micro expressions.
And it's all built on this assumption we all have Muslim migrant societies that did not fit in to the host culture.
Right.
And that's quite a challenge for us to. It's so false. It's almost like the kind of Nazi propaganda that you have such a big lie that the bigger the lie is, the more difficult it is then to diffuse it. It's such a big lie that I think we are, at the beginning, we're a bit paralyzed when we try to challenge it because it's so false. And yet, I think we have to be patient and unpack it again for the audiences and make sure that people understand how ridiculous and dangerous it is for both case studies.
Ilan Pape, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I'm Max Blumenthal in Washington, D.C. for The Real News.
That was Max Blumenthal interviewing Israeli historian Ilan Pape on his new book, 10 Myths About Israel. And before we end this morning, I want to read a news account from Telesure that wraps up the Palestinian prisoners' hunger strike, which is now mercifully over. After more than 1,500 Palestinian prisoners staged a mass historic hunger strike for 40 days, the Palestinian Committee of Prisoners officially confirmed that nearly 80% of the prisoners' demands were met as the strike ended. Issa Korag, director of the Palestinian Prisoners Affairs Commission, spoke at a press conference Sunday, declaring the victory an important achievement to build on the future on the basis of the protection of the prisoners' rights and dignity. Among the many conditions prisoners wanted to be improved that the Israeli Prisoner Service agreed to include expanding access to telephones, lifting the security ban on hundreds of family members of Palestinian prisoners, including the 140 children who were denied visits from parents, allowing distant family members to visit their imprisoned relatives, and other MET demands include establishing in every prison department a separate kitchen area for the preparation of food, allowing photographs with parents once annually or with a prisoner's spouse, stocking prison stores with higher quality goods, including fruits and vegetables, introducing modern recreational equipment in the recreation yards, and transferring prisoners to prisons closer to their families, places of residence. The end of the strike will also see the return of prisoners who were transferred to their original locations and the lifting of sanctions imposed on the hunger-striking prisoners. Additional negotiations will be held around the prisoners' other demands. The Samadoun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, in a published statement, said, and we quote, "On this occasion of the prisoners' victory, we know that there is a long struggle to come for liberation for the prisoners and liberation for Palestine. We urge all the Palestinian communities, supporters of Palestine, and social justice organizers who took to the streets, drank salt water, engaged in hunger strikes, expressed their solidarity, and organized across borders and walls to celebrate the victory of the prisoners with events and actions on June 4th to 6th in celebrations of dignity and victory. In these celebrations, we will recognize the power of the Palestinian people to defeat the occupier and the colonizer, honor the prisoners and their steadfastness, and emphasize the ongoing struggle," the group added. Unquote. After 40 days, the health of many prisoners was deteriorating rapidly, with 182 striking political prisoners having been hospitalized. The strike was met with solidarity demonstrations throughout occupied Palestine and around the world, with near daily demonstrations, rallies, protests, and strikes. That was a wrap-up of the Palestinian Prisoners' Hunger Strike, published by Telesure. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To hear the program later in the day, we realize that 8 a.m. on Sunday morning is awfully early for some, or to listen at any other time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive immediately, but is there for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, to reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.